This is CliffCentral.com.
It is no small thing to have your roots in a place called Mahlabatini in KwaZulu-Natal and to grow up and make your mark on the South African political landscape to the extent that the whole world knows your name and that you've made a significant contribution to the history of this country. And yet there is a man who continues to do this at the age of 90 years old, and he sits opposite me today. He is uNdunankulu weSizwe samaZulu. He is the Prime Minister of the Zulu Nation and of the Zulu Royal Monarch. And he's here today. He's well known to many people as Mangosuthu Buthelezi, the President of the IFP. Sir, it's a pleasure to see you. Thank you for coming to speak to us this morning. I've been looking forward to this. It's really something that I have been for a long, long time an admirer of your work and someone who has paid quite a lot of attention to your own story and the story of the IFP, because I'm a history student, I can't help myself. And you are as much a part of our present, and you are still so much a fixture in South African politics, but you are also very much a man who embodies so much of the history of this country. And to me, that is an interesting overlap in an area which I'd like to explore. So first and foremost, there is, in 90 years, a lot of people would have experienced, you know, many interesting things, but you seem to have experienced all of them. Because when you started and you were born in the 1920s, South Africa was a very different place to where we are now. And your own parents, your parents were, of course, Chief Mathole Buthelezi and then Princess Magogo Kadinizulu. They must have grown up in an even more different South Africa, but a South Africa which we can still read about in the history books.
Absolutely.
So tell me about the circumstances of your birth and how you first started to experience life in South Africa and what it felt like to be a young man born in these very, very difficult and dangerous times in South Africa.
Well, I'm told that I was born on the 27th of August, 1928, and that after my birth, I was immediately taken to my uncle's palace, my mother's brother's palace, King Solomon Maphumzane kaDinizulu, at KwaDlamahlahla Palace, where I not only spent my infancy, but where I spent my life, because I stayed there until I had also gone to the primary school there, at the school for which my uncle, Prince Mshiyeni kaDinizulu, actually set up after the death of his brother, King Solomon. And this is where I did my primary school. The school was called Usutu Primary School, but later it was called Mpumalanga. That's where I went to school until standard 7. And then after that, I went to Adams College, south of Durban, at Mazimtoti, where I did my junior and senior secondary education. And then I matriculated in 1947, and in 1948, when the National Party acceded to power in South Africa, I went to the University of Fort Hare.
Yes.
Where I studied, majoring in what was called Native Administration and History, and where I was taught some legal subjects by a very prominent South African professor, Zachariah Geodirling Matthews, who was the deputy principal of the university. He taught me criminal law, he taught me Roman Dutch law, even my major. I did constitutional law for non-degree purposes. Then, of course, there was a visit then, just when I was going to present my majors, mm-hmm, in 1950, of the then head of state in South Africa, a man by the name of Dr. G. Brand van Sale, happened to be going through Alice. It was decided that he pays a courtesy visit to the University of Water. By that time, I joined the African National Congress Youth League branch at Fort Hare. But prior to that, of course, I must say that when I was doing matric, my first taste of being close to political figures was when I was doing matric.
Mm-hmm.
Because during vacations, the founder of the African National Congress, Dr. Pixley Kaisaka Seme, had built a homestead not far from the palace, and he happened to have an operation in one of his eyes. In fact, I think, if I remember well, they removed it. And then he would call for me at the palace and dictate letters to me and sign them and so on.
It's extraordinary.
So this is my closest, my first...
So you spent quite a lot of time with Pixley. With,
an important figure of...
That's incredible.
Of the country, the founder of the ANC.
Hmm.
So then I think that we decided then, as members of the ANC Youth League, that we were going to boycott the visit because the Governor General was supposed to address us at the Christian Union Hall, which was an assembly hall for the university. And then we decided not to go there. But then some people sneaked in. They went. Some were quite vociferous, mm-hmm, in urging us not to go. And then as students, we decided to punish them by throwing water on their beds and things like that. And I and my friends were then rusticated from the university.
Yes. And while you were at university, you met two other very famous political people and who were students at the time, Robert Mugabe, who was studying there, and Robert Sobukwe.
Yes, Robert Sobukwe was actually a very close friend and actually the first chairperson of the ANC Youth League branch was advocate, a man who became advocate, Godfrey Beecher.
Mm.
You know, he was an advocate here in Johannesburg. But when he left, then Robert Sobukwe became our chairman of the ANC Youth League at Fort Hare.
What were your overwhelming memories of people like Pixley and Sobukwe? Because these people to us are figures of history in some ways. We didn't know them personally, and we can only read about them. But from your memory, was there a sort of personality characteristic or a common trait, something about them as leaders that inspired you, that made you think that this was something that you wanted to do in politics too? Or were you just...
So he was an extraordinary person.
This is Robert...
I remember his speech.
Pixley or Robert Sobukwe? Who we... Sobukwe. Okay, yes.
No,
are we talking about Sobukwe?
Yes, I thought you were asking me about him.
Yes, I was. I was asking you about a number of them. But yes, let's talk Sobukwe.
I can only talk about one at a time.
No, I have you. Okay, Sobukwe.
Robert Sobukwe, I think, was quite an extraordinary person. Because I remember his speech, which he delivered extempo, and yet actually he had a photographic mind because that speech was available in black and white, but he delivered it word for word without looking at the text. He was a very great orator, a great Africanist even then. As I remember, this issue of land, which is so topical, it was very foremost amongst the things that he talked about at the time. And I remember that he would say, "We want our land back." And when we talk about our land, we mean the whole of Africa. And he would, in the air, draw the map of Africa. You know, he said he wanted every inch by the time he got to South Africa, you know, in the air. Very great orator that he was. Then, of course, then he came, of course, came up here to Wits, and later became a lecturer. He first taught at Standerton and then became a lecturer here at Wits. That's when yesterday I was talking to at a rally, saying that as Minister of Home Affairs, I'm the one who we had to deal with the holidays. And in fact, I would have preferred that the Human Rights Day be called Robert Sobukwe Human Rights Day, because Sharpeville was actually not even an action of our own organization, ANC. It was a PAC thing.
When you had finished university, I think it was around about the time you were
1950.
You might still have been there, but you did meet the architect of apartheid at some point. You met H.F. Verwoerd.
1955, yes.
Now, what was that meeting? Under what auspices was it held? What did you two discuss?
Well, actually, I was already installed as Inkosi of the Buthelezi clan, and I was also assisting my cousin, King Cyprian Peguzulu Kasolomoni Katini Zulu, the present king's father.
Yes.
And all Amakosi chiefs, as we were called at the time, were summoned to Nongoma, which was the seat of the king, because Dr. Verwoerd was then the Minister of Native Affairs, in charge of Native Affairs, was going to address us. So we went up there, and of course, foremost in the agenda was the implementation of the Bantu Authorities Act of 1951, which was going to lay the foundation for the homelands policy of trying to fragment the country into, you know, independent states, mini states. So they were very clever, because they would say that the act was merely permissive, and that any Inkosi and his clan can accept it, because they wanted to have the moral cover that we took it of our own volition. So I think we Zulu people were the last to comply. In fact, I myself complied only, you know, after they sent two senior officials who then said to me, in fact, the other officials who told us that we had any option were, to quote them verbatim, were wrongly instructed, unquote, and that therefore there was no choice, in fact. So I complied then. Because they used all sorts of tactics to try and persuade me, because my argument, whenever they came to the Buthelezi clan, I said to them, if this is a form of government, then the people must accept it. And my people kept on saying, no, they wanted to watch those who accepted it and see how it works before they make up their minds. They kept on saying so. But when the king had accepted it, my cousin, then they started taunting me, saying that, you know, how can I, as a descendant of Mnyamana Buthelezi, who was king, which was prime minister, how can I not comply now that the king has actually accepted it? And I always say to people, I learned quite a lot from very simple advisors of my father, the Indunas, and some of my old uncles, because they had some amazing wisdom. I remember one of our senior Indunas, Njane Mbana Mate. He was a short little chap, but very, very powerful, you know, actually, you know, dynamite, as we say, it comes in small packages. And when they taunted me about the king, he would say to the official, are you suggesting, you an analogy, he would say, you mean to say if the two of them, the king and our Inkosi Mangosuthu, are riding horses on a rainy day, if the king horse slips and he falls, he must also fall. No. Which I thought was an amazing way of putting things. So then, Dr. Verwoerd, this is what the question was. Then he came to address us. First of all, they wanted to speak to the king alone. I said that we should not allow, I addressed other Makos and said, we cannot allow our king to go alone, to be talked to alone. So later on at that meeting, the meeting chose people who were going to be spokesmen when the meeting, you know, got going. And they chose an old prince, Prince Piga, Gastie Gumpandi, in other words, a grandson of King Pandi. And they chose a very prominent leader of the African National Congress, Mr. Alison Vessels Champion, who was a very colorful figure because he founded the ICU with Clemens Kadali, you remember, the first African vibrant trade union in South Africa. And then they chose Inkosi Chief Charles Boy Hlengwa and myself. So we're the five spokesperson, and I remember that the Mercury particularly referred to my remarks, in particular after the following day. And Mr. Champion had a column in the Zulu, isiZulu newspaper called Ilang. And it was entitled Ukubonwa Mahlathi. What Mahlathi was his nickname. And he was commenting on that meeting with Verwoerd, and he said, well, other people spoke and so on, but one could hear when the young span of the speakers started speaking. Of course, the youngest of the team was myself. So after that, then, of course, they started having regional authorities, which were now the district council of the district under the Band Authorities Act. Then in 1970, they wanted to set up now the territorial authority, which meant all the whole of the Zulu nation. So Amakhosi were housed in tents in Nongoma, where the meeting was taking place. And I remember vividly that time, because ever since I was expelled from Fort Hare, I was shadowed very heavily by the security police. They would go about even asking people that I talked to and refer to me as a communist. So that evening prior to the meeting, to the election of the first team to mend the territorial authority, members of the security police and members of what was called the Department of Information, you remember, Department of Information that finally toppled Mr. Foster himself, with people like Dr. Rudy and so on. They were going from tent to tent, warning Amakhosi not to make the mistake of supporting me for the position of leading this. In the meantime, I, as a young member of the ANC, had received a message from my sister, who was married to a medical here on what was called the Reef then, the Ren, in Pinoni, a township called Davidton. And they sent one of the very senior leaders by the name of Klopas Ntsebande to my sister to say, although our movement, that is the ANC, was against it, they are urging me, because Nkosi Albert Luthuli, the present general, and Mr. Tambo, that I should not refuse. You'd rather that I should be the one who is at the helm than anyone else, so that we can ensure that we abort it.
Wow.
So of course, the department or the government was not very amused by this. They were very unhappy about the fact that I was chosen now as the official leader of the party government of the Zulu people. And of course, this thing went through constitutional stages. We later became a legislative assembly, and finally we became the government of KwaZulu.
Mm.
And I became the chief minister, which was quite an experience, because they knew, the government was under no delusion that I was almost what you can call the Trojan horse of the ANC. So I think we suffered a lot because of that, because on a per capita basis, we asked Deloitte and Touche, a very reputable chartered accountant company, who discovered that on a per capita basis, we're getting less funding than all the other homelands.
Really?
Which was, of course, sort of punitive, because it was headed by me. So since I believe in self-help and self-reliance, I called upon, appealed to Amakhosi and said that we must actually ask our people to pay a rand each to build schools, so that on that pittance which was given to us as a budget, then we'd keep a rand to build classrooms, which we built. And then, of course, I used to come up here in the Reef and speak at the Jabulani Amphitheater here in Soweto. I remember in particular in March, I delivered a speech which I entitled "In This Approaching Hour of Crisis," where I warned about what I saw as a looming crisis in South Africa, some social unrest. In fact, I remember at the time there was someone in Soweto then who was head of the administration of the city.
Mm-hmm.
They used to have such structures at that time. And in fact, when the Soweto thing erupted, he actually blamed me that I had come up from KwaZulu to incite people in Soweto. He tried to blame me on that. Of course, it's a time that is something that we can never forget. The uprising by young people who were shot with live ammunition by the police, who tried to retaliate with stones, and so on. By that time, of course, because Albert Luthuli had already established abroad what was called the ANC Mission in Exile, headed by Mr. Tambo. So prior to that, in 1963, since I worship in the Anglican Church, my diocese of Zululand had to nominate a delegation of three people, the bishop, a member of the clergy, and a layman. And I was the layman that was elected then in 63. So we had to go to Toronto in Canada, where the Anglican Congress of the Anglican Communion throughout the world met. Delegations, bishop, priests, and laymen. So we stopped in London. Then I decided to go and see Mrs. Adelaide Tambo, because Tambo was in Lusaka. Then Adelaide Tambo then phoned Oliver Tambo, who then flew from Lusaka to London to see me. And because we met at the house at Muswell Road in London, Mr. Tambo was very unhappy and very nervous about the fact that I met them in their house. Because at that time, it was common knowledge that the Bureau for State Security, the acronym of which was BOSS,
yeah,
had agents all over the world. And he said they must have noted that I had seen them. But you see, being younger, I thought he was going too far myself, you know. But clearly, it was clear afterwards that, of course, he was more experienced than myself. Because, in fact, when I returned to South Africa, my passport was confiscated by the government.
Because you had visited the Tangos?
Confiscated for 9 years.
Wow.
My friend Helen Suzman tried, Mr. Mitchell, we was a prominent UP leader, were in parliament, tried, they wouldn't give it to me. But as you know, we black people were not allowed to go to put our dirty feet in any hotel. But something very strange, I think about 71, took place. A leader of an independent country, Dr. Hastings Banda of Malawi, then decides to pay a state visit to South Africa. Then one of the conditions we were told that he made was, because the whole of Africa was horrified that how could any head of state visit an apartheid when our people are treated like this. But he did that. He said that he wants to talk, he wants to have dialogue as one gentleman to another.
Mm-hmm.
He was going to talk to Mr. Foster. He defied all that. So then he made a condition that when he leaves, he would like to host a banquet for the government. But then in that banquet, he insisted that he wanted to have black leaders, black guests. So the government was in a fix. They looked around. Where were they going to get these honorary whites? And they suddenly saw us as leaders of the homeland, as honorary whites. So for the first time, we attended the banquet here in a Botany in Johannesburg. And of course, the media had a field day, you know, with pictures in the Star, because Dr. Banda was not married, but he had what was called a hostess, Miss Kazamira, and a couple of other women. So they were sitting there in the hotel near Foster. And of course, at that time, it was unbelievable that you could share a meal with black
but
people.
But
it
shows you how absurd the whole apartheid system was. Absurd.
So, subsequent to that, then Dr. Banda decides to invite Hosi Mangope, who was then the chief minister of Bophuthatswana, and myself.
Mm.
He invites us to Malawi to attend their independence celebrations. So we then went to Malawi. And of course, I still remember the advice that President Banda was giving to me. He said, don't try a confrontation, Mr. Foster. Do you understand? You know, then and so on. And then, of course, I thought that Hosi Mangope was going to speak, but he asked me to speak at the banquet at Mount Socha Hotel in what you call, because it was before Lilongwe was built. It was in
Blantyre. Blantyre?
It was in Blantyre. It was in Blantyre. So, well, we attended the celebrations, and then I'm a bit taken aback, because one of the ministers of Dr. Banda comes to me, and he whispers to me that, you know, of course, in the first place, Dr. Banda said to me, you know, you must go up to Mzimba to see the Ngoni people. Abengoni, these are your people. These are Malawian Zulus. And so my wife and I and the person who accompanied me, we've flown right up to Mzimba, to the Ngoni people. And I remember we started visiting a old mission in Bangweni. And I remember singing a song, What a Friend We Have in Jesus, in isiZulu. They tested up old hymn books. It was very emotional for me. Then I was honored by their King Mbelwa. I don't know, the third or the fourth. Then, in whispering, the minister says that, after that, the president, His Excellency, says that, since you've been voted child, Mangope had already left for South Africa. So I was remaining in Malawi. And then he says he has arranged for me and my wife and the person who accompanied me to go to one of the resorts. You know, the resorts are around Malawi Lake, Lake Malawi, a place called Mangoche. And then comes a bombshell. He says, when you are there, you'll also meet with Oliver Tambo.
Oh, really?
So I get very uneasy because, you know, I take it for granted that President Banda has a good relationship with Mr. Foster at that time. And I wondered now, is
it a setup? Yeah.
But in fact, it turned out it was just a very African patriotic act on his part. Because in fact, Mr. Tambo did in fact arrive. But you won't believe it, that his message at that time, since everyone, you see, because as soon as I became the chief minister, I spoke very, very forthrightly in South Africa, and I was the only voice. So Mr. Tambo had come to give me advice. He said that I was rocking the boat too much. And he said I must even soft pedal. He said in times I must even criticize the ANC and so on. Which advice, of course, I didn't quite welcome. Because I wouldn't see how I can criticize my own organization. Because I was still basically a cadre of the ANC.
Can I just...
Certainly. Yes.
To talk about the ANC for a minute, because it's ironic that you did spend much of your life as an ANC member.
Yes.
And that the ANC had such a formidable role to play in your own life and your own political education. But ultimately, if we fast forward into the 1970s, there became there were differences that for you were too much to deal with, that there were things that you didn't agree with.
Yes, I'm going to get to this. So that's how we met. So then they decided as a policy to actually advocate the imposition of economic sanctions and disinvestment on South Africa. Now, I would come up here to Soweto and speak about it, whether in fact I should support it, and the people would say no. I remember another visit to Langa in Cape Town at the hostel. I addressed a big rally of members of the hostel and they, when I raised the issue whether I should support it, they said no. I also went to Bloemfontein, Kroonstad, Welkom, and other places. And at each place, when I raised the issue, our people would say that they would starve. I must not support it. So the Americans, you know, started a debate on it, and they would arrange these debates in some of the independent African states. So in 1974, they arranged such a debate in Addis Ababa, in Ethiopia. And they invited both Mr. Tambo and myself. So Mr. Tambo arranged that we should meet in Nairobi. And we both stayed in the same hotel, the Hilton. And I remember we talked that day, just across the night, about the debate. And Mr. Tambo, is my leader, said, no, I should go up to Addis Ababa, but that he would not go, although invited, because he said it would look bad if the two of us, as leaders from South Africa, disagreed on an international platform. So I went up, and of course, a very historic visit where I met the Lion of Judah,
Haile Selassie.
Haile Selassie, so on. It was just before the coup d'etat that they had. So taking advantage, you know, Mr. Cliff, of the fact that I was outside of South Africa, I then arranged to have a meeting with President Kaunda and President Nyerere to thank them for giving sanctuary to all our exiles. So I went to, in fact, the Kenyans were celebrating their independence too. I remember going to the cathedral, Anglican Cathedral, with Mr. Njonjo, who was the, Attorney General of Kenya. At the time, he had been educated also like me at Adams and Fort Hare. So we left by the same plane with Mr. Tambo to Lusaka now, where I was an arrangement to see President Kaunda. So my wife and I were very warmly received, and the person accompanying me, Mrs. Lalda, and we had dinner at the State House. Then Dr. Kaunda then said, he has arranged for me to visit the office the following day of his party, UNIP. And he said, after I'd visited, I must come back to State House to meet with him again. And then I did so. In the State House, I found the top crust, the top brass of their party, UNIP, who included Mr. Mainza Chona, who was then the Prime Minister of Zambia,
mm-hmm.
of Zambia. Then President Kaunda then says to me, you know, we as frontlines, you know, they were called frontline states then, we as leaders of frontline states appreciate that you have become a lone voice in South Africa, and we appreciate the work we're doing, but we think it's not enough. We think that you should start a membership-based organization. So I was startled by that. How could I do that as a member of ANC? So I had to consult my leader, Mr. Tambo. I sent an emissary to him. Strangely, Mr. Tambo said, I must go ahead. So when I got here, I consulted one of my great mentors, Bishop Alpheus Zulu. How do I do this? He then suggested that, you know, your uncle, King Solomon, had started a cultural organization in 1928. He said, because if you just start straight away and say you're funding a political organization, it will be burned. So it's better for you. He said that was called Inkatha, even if you don't make it confined to Zulus, but call it, if you can call it Inkatha. So we called it Inkatha Enkululeko Yesizwe, to make a distinction that we're not Inkatha KaZulu, National Cultural Liberation Movement. It was called in English. So on the 21st, that's why yesterday I had to cut the cake in Soweto, because it was our birthday as well. Because it was founded on the 21st of March too. So, as time goes on, this debate, I mean, before that, shall I say, in 76, you know, right through the international community, there were all sorts of pressures, of course, on the apartheid regime here. And in 76, to my surprise, there had been a coup in Nigeria, and the head of the then junta government was General Olusegun Obasanjo. So he sends a ticket for me, he sends a ticket for my wife, he sends a ticket for my secretary, he sends a ticket for Mr. Tula, who was our urban representative here in Johannesburg, here on the Reef. There's on this day, Transkei got independence. He said, he was making sure that I shouldn't attend that fuss. But in any case, I wasn't going to attend.
So you didn't go to Nigeria either?
Quite so. But on that day, as they were celebrating Mtata, I was speaking at the Institute for International Affairs in Lagos.
Huh.
Then I went to go home. Then I'm told from State House that the head of state, Olusegun Obasanjo, says, no, I must stay for a few days because he has also invited Tambo. But Tambo didn't arrive now on the day he was supposed to come. So I couldn't stay in Nigeria indefinitely. I stayed at the federal guest house with Sam Nujoma, who later became president of Namibia. Strangely, at the airport, there was Tambo arriving. So we chatted for a short time while I was waiting for the plane. And that meeting, which Olusegun Obasanjo did not take place.
It's just amazing. See, it's amazing to me. Your life has such intersections with so many of these people.
But
all these amazing people, and you met them all, you interacted with them all. It's such an incredible life. I mean, we think only of the last sort of 20 or 30 years of most recent South African history, but Sam Nujoma, Olusegun Obasanjo, who eventually became the president there as well, people like Kaunda and Nyerere, and these are people who, for most of us, are relegated to the pages of history books. These were people you knew well.
Absolutely. Because you see now, the debate now was hotting up of imposing economic sanctions and disinvestment. Then Mr. Tambo suggested to me that I should come to London with a delegation of Inkatha. So I went to London in October, to the end of October 1979, where there were 16 others who were with me in my delegation. So we met at the airport, Hotel Excelsior Hotel, at the airport in London for 2.5 days. And the two subjects he puts on the table, he wanted us, as Inkatha, to support economic sanctions and disinvestment. Two, he also wanted us to support the armed struggle, which they started. But clearly, of course, we could not agree. But our discussion was quite friendly. It was not acrimonious. I remember them in the evening showing us some videos of their army to show us what they were doing on the screen. But the army, they only showed us their feet, not their faces. We only saw the feet marching.
Yeah, well, I'm busted.
So then here in Johannesburg, I had another contemporary of mine was Dr. Motlana. You know, because he had been at Fort Hare with me. So Dr. Motlana, I had mentioned in addressing people at Langa in Cape Town that I had met with Mr. Tambo. And Dr. Motlana said Tambo could not meet a traitor, you see. So in my discussion then in London 79, I raised this matter that these people are, some people are sniping at me, you know, and one of them, Motlana, said this. Of course, Tambo said he was going to come back to me, and he condemned it. He said that, in fact, to put me together with other homeland leaders who had already even accepted independence was absolutely wrong, because those are the people they can call traitors, he said. But he was supposed to come back to me in December. But sadly, I must emphasize, in June 1980, the Secretary General of the ANC, Mr. Alfred Nzo, delivered a scathing address attacking me in London, calling me all sorts of names, saying I'm a political careerist and so on, you know. I would say that even during that time, of course, people who claim that you're talking for ANC here would criticize me. But I would say literally that the sluice gates were opened after 1980, because I was then attacked through Freedom, Radio Freedom, through their publication like Sichawa, you know, all sorts of things. But to go back to the 1979 meeting, I would like you to note that, to my surprise, you know, in London, there was a journalist who was the chief of the Bureau of the Sunday Times by the name of Sue Vos. Sue Vos published a story on the first page of the Sunday Times here in our country about our meeting. And Mr. Tambo actually issued a statement denying that the meeting took place at all. He said it was not true. And later when they turned against me, he accused me that I'm the one who leaked it. But of course, Sue Vos actually made a statement clearly saying that he got his information from a certain Mr. Cap Zungu. Cap Zungu was a representative of the ANC in London. In fact, he was the son of one of our Anglican priests in Claremont. And he said that he got news. He's the one who leaked it, but not me.
And you said that term.
Then, of course, a thing which is important, you know, Ms. Cliff, to emphasize that, as you know, Madiba and I were not only just fellow members of the ANC, but we're also house friends, we're friends. So even when this thing happened, this rapture, if I may call it, our relationships continued. And I remember him asking me whether I should not visit Tambo in Lusaka. But at that time, there were rumors that I was already in the list of those who must be killed. So I wouldn't go. I didn't take Matiba's advice. But he continued to. He didn't participate with them.
Did your relationship with Tambo break down? Did your relationship with Oliver Tambo break down after that?
Yes, because, I mean, this was the end of it. It broke down after that. And, of course, you know that after his death, both, I think, his widow and son have issued this book entitled Tambo Speaks, where the scathing statement by Tambo again attacking me in it, you know. But in 89, Madiba, because you know, you're aware, as I'm sure as a journalist, that the letters that Ms. Madiba wrote to people have been published. And yes. And you can see some of the letters he wrote to me and some to my wife and so on, published there. So in 1989, he wrote the last letter before he was released, where he was worried about what he called the black-on-black violence that cost, you know, 20,000 lives in South Africa. And saying that he think he was about to be released, and he thought that as soon as he was released, he must get in touch so that he and I can address what was a shameful, fratricidal, you know, clash amongst ourselves as black people. So, in fact, then Madiba was, then, of course, in South Africa, let me recall that the American State Department had been issuing invitations to me to visit Washington, but because I was passportless then, before then, I couldn't. So as soon as I had a passport, in 1971, they invited me to visit on a leadership grant to go to the United States. And in the United States, of course, on my return, I had a press conference at the airport here in Johannesburg, and And I said that many people said that since I was a leader of a Biden government, do we meet with Mr. Foster and so on? So I said, I've never met him. I don't even know him. But soon thereafter, a meeting was arranged with Mr. Foster of himself and all of us as homeland leaders, so-called. Later, we would only see them one by one. In September 1973, I made sure that we had a meeting in Mtata. At this meeting, we decided that no, we should approach, we should not agree to see Mr. Foster one by one, which in promoting this fragmentation and balkanization of the country, we should ask for an appointment together, which in fact he granted us in 73. And I remember that in preparation, we decided to give each other subjects. And one of the subjects that were given to me was the release of Mandela. That I had to deal with that when we met him.
What was his reaction to it?
So I remember raising that, you know, eyeball to eyeball with him, that asking that Mandela be released. Mr. Foster said to me, no, he will not release him. He said he was posting in court that he was a communist, and if there is anything that my father taught me, was never to put an order under my bosom. And as long as I'm prime minister, I will never release him, he said. But of course, he was referring to the fact that at Rivonia, there was a document, which was an exhibit in court, of a document which on how to become a good communist, which was written by Ms. Mandela in his handwriting. But it's not true that he was posting, but that was the document which was referring to.
So, go on.
So then, I remember also Inkosi Mangope saying to me that Inkosi Matanzima and Dr. Sebe had talked to him and said the way we're talking to Mr. Foster, we seem to forget that these people are our masters, the manner in which we talk. And I remember that when I was speaking also on this issue of Mandela, they switched on to vernacular to me and said, Pez, I'm Shegaz, Pez, meaning that I must tone down.
you didn't take instruction
quite,
well.
Quite,
But you didn't, you took instruction badly from everyone, and this is sort of why you ended up such a singular man of principle in politics. Yeah. You mentioned how Inkatha came about first as a cultural organization and a members-based thing.
Correct. And yes, I've omitted a very important thing that happened in 1977.
Yes.
Because in 1977, I was suddenly summoned, you know, it was after Soweto. I was suddenly summoned by the Minister of Police and Justice, that was Mr. Jimmy Kruger. He summoned me to Pretoria, and he was there with the Commissioner of Police, and he said to me that if I didn't confine membership of Inkatha to Zulus only, he'll take action, he'll be forced to take action against me. So I said, but you have also whites of different ethnic groups in the National Party. Oh, he said, oh no, but you know our origin is Teutonic and so on. So I said, what about the Jews? So of course he didn't know what to say. So I resisted any agreement not to confine, not to, you know, to recruit other Africans who are not Zulus into Inkatha then. You know, a lot of lies, especially promoted by some in the media, was that, of course, Inkatha was a Zulu organization. But even at that time, there was the university in, what do you call, of Freiburg in Germany, at a survey where, in fact, where a high percentage, about more than 40% of members were not Zulu-speaking at that time. So then what happened then, we decided then to go and see, then Mr. Foster, there was a big scandal about information and the so-called Mothergate.
Yes.
And then Mr. Foster is forced to resign. Then P.W. Porter takes over as Prime Minister to start with. Then we decided, as homeland leader, so-called, to see him together. And they agreed that we should come and see them. Only to find that when we go to Cape Town, we're called into the office like schoolboys into a schoolmaster's office one by one, you know. Because they said they didn't recognize us together. Mr. Porter wouldn't recognize us together individually. So when it came to my turn, he was there, Dr. Kurnov, who was Minister, of course, of
State Information.
Our affairs, Blake. So, as I always do, I had an aid memo, which I read at that time. Then immediately, Dr. Kurnov says that he's asking me not to show that memorandum to the media. So I said, you know, Minister, there are many things I'm not allowed to do in South Africa. But if there's anything I can do, is that I can do what I like with my memorandum. Mr. Porter turned red. I remember my young secretary always remarked that he saw this part of his body moving
that. His chin.
Yes, he was very angry. He pointed a finger at me. He said, yes, this is why you didn't get along with my predecessors, because you tried to communicate with him through the media, and so on. Chided me. Oh, Dr. Poor Dr. Kurnov. I was accompanied by Dr. Mzalose then, who was my Minister of Health. Dr. Mzalose, Dr. Kurnov, Dr. Mzalose, please talk to him. Yeah, you must talk to me and persuade me not to. I just would not be persuaded. So there was the end. After that, for five years, even when we were invited officially, I wouldn't attend anything, you know. So for 5 years, I didn't have anything to do with Mr. Porter or the government. So then I'm now approached by Dr. Anton Rupert. Mr. Anton Rupert says to me, you know, some of us as Afrikaners are really not happy that you and our leader are not in touch. Would you mind if I arrange a private meeting for you and Mr. Porter at Somerset West in our company's house, company's quarters? So I said, well, I didn't mind. So we met, in fact, with Ms. P.W. Porter, and he was accompanied by Dr. Filion, Dr. Gerrit Filion, and I was accompanied by Bishop Zulu and Dr. Oscar Dlomo, who was our Secretary General. So we smoked the pipe of peace with Mr. Porter. So after that, for the first time then, he visited Lundi, visited KwaZulu for the first time. Well, there's a big thing in the Legislative Assembly and so on. Then he says, later we're told, this is me and my ministers, that in the evening, you know, there are always those officials that they called Commissioner General, mm-hmm. who are supposed to be an ambassador to the Zulu people.
Right.
We're told that we're going to have dinner with Mr. What do you call?
Porter.
Yeah, but Mr. Porter at this place. So we did have dinner with Mr. Porter.
There was no finger wagging, there was no...
No, it was a dinner. We just had dinner with him. So then, after the dinner, the women moved in a certain direction. we the ministers and my ministers and I and him in a room, in an adjoining room. He then says to me, you know, at the function this morning, I like the first part of the of your speech. Oh, meaning, of course, the preliminaries where I was welcoming him and so on. But I didn't like this second part of it, he says. And then he said to me, you know, I can be nasty even to my most senior ministers. So I said, well, Prime Minister, the white man has been nasty to me all my life. Of course, you could see officials turning pale when I said this. They just going pale. So then the other things, of course, is that, of course, you remember then he had unfortunately stroke. Then a new man comes into the scene.
De Klerk.
By the name of Mr. F.W. De Klerk. Then Mr. F.W. De Klerk says to me, no, he invites me and he tells me we must negotiate the future. So I said, okay, but let us have a few of your men, I'll get some from my side, a committee, to actually interrogate the issue of what are the factors that impede negotiations, what are the factors. I remember that on my side, I had Mr. Rowley Arenstein, who was a lawyer that the ANC used in Durban, and was the longest banned person in South Africa, and a member of the Communist Party. So in our response, we say, okay, let's negotiate. But what is non-negotiable? There is no way under any circumstances that we can be part of negotiations if people in jail like Mr. Mandela and others are not part of it, if people in exile like Tambo and so on and other parties are not there. So, in fact, Inkatha had been campaigning for quite a long time for the release of Mandela. We celebrated his birthday when he was 70 years and so on. So, that is why then, in February 1990, when Mr. De Klerk spoke in Parliament, the only name he mentioned was mine, as having assisted him to release Mr. Mandela.
Historic. That was the unbanning as well.
Pardon?
That was the unbanning of the ANC and other political organizations.
Yeah.
And then the wheels started to turn.
Absolutely. But then, you know, something, what do you call, just at that time happens. Madiba, of course, phones me afterwards and we must meet soon, as in accordance with the letter that he wrote to me. But that meeting, for some reason, is February, March, April, May. It doesn't happen. Then Madiba visits Mthatha, his home. So Amakhosi, the chiefs, as we were called then, say to him, but you and Buthelezi are such close friends. Have you met? He said, members of the United Democratic Front almost throttled me. He used the word throttle, saying that I must meet that man. He said they forbade me. So he became more captive outside jail than he was in jail. Huh. It was not until the 29th of January 1991 when we met with Madiba at the Royal Hotel in Durban with a delegation. I remember that Mr. Big was the scribe on his side. On my side, the scribe was Mr. Walter Felgate. Mr. Walter Felgate had been given to me by Dr. Bayes Nondi, with whom I worked closely, of the Christian Institute. And he said that he must come and help me. So in our joint communique at the end, we say, we decide that from now onwards, to address the violence, we'll always have, we are going to address many joint rallies of the ANC and the NGAT, we agree. A few weeks after that, I'm invited by the IFP in Maritzburg, in a place called Taylor's Halt. Then I phone my diva and say, here's an opportunity for us to have the joint rally. He agreed with alacrity, if I may say, that we should do so. Mm. But as the days were drawing closer, Dr. Dlomo then says to me, he hears Madiba is no longer going with me. So I phone Madiba. Madiba, there's a rumor that you're not going. He says to me, man, you don't know what happened. I said, what happened? He said, you know, Harry Kwala, who is the leader of the ANC in your province, and also the leader of the Communist Party, brought a busload. You remember that there used to be a shell house before?
Yes.
He brought a busload of leaders from the whole province of Natal, as it was then, to say, under no circumstances should you go with Buthelezi there. That man is killing our people. So that meeting was aborted. In the meantime, people were dying on both sides.
They were dying. They were dying in KwaZulu-Natal. They were dying in the East Rand.
Yes.
It was
Then, of course, negotiations start, Kempton Park and so on. Then I raised the issue of the king. And I'm surprised the ANC and others, they say, but since Inkatha is there, he's represented. I said, no. The king has nothing to do with Inkatha. He should represent it, you know, in his own right. So that issue rose until they agreed to that. Then we had a representative. Then in the negotiations, I raised the whole issue of the place of the monarchy within
constitutional democracy.
Within a democratic.
Yes.
You know, dispensation.
Mm.
So I suggest that we should have international mediators. So we went to Kruger Park. Mr. F.W. de Klerk, the King, Mr. Mandela, myself, to talk about this, and we agreed on the principle that it should be done. But you remember that prior to that, during negotiations, the National Party and the and ANC went into what they call the Bosperad, into the bush. And there they agreed that any agreement between them is sufficient consensus.
Well, they tried to negotiate you out, to block you out of that discussion.
Well, precisely.
They chose at the last minute that they would try to sway the king on their own and cut you out of the deal, effectively. And you came back at them and you managed to get things back on track.
Quite. So, you know, this happened now, sadly, when the international mediators had already arrived, consisting of quite important people in the international community, Dr. Henry Kissinger, a former Secretary of State of the United States, Lord Carrington, who was involved in all negotiations with our independent countries like Rhodesia and so on, and Kenya, and Mr. Justice Hicks Bottom from America, former Chief Justice from India, an academic. They actually arrived here in Johannesburg with their bags prepared to start negotiation. Mm-hmm. But you know, the spokesman of the two organizations, ANC and the National Party, was our president, Mr. Ramaphosa
and Rolf Meyer.
Mr. Rolf Meyer.
Yeah.
So they torpedoed it. So in Catalan decides, I say, I, as the king's prime minister, cannot continue, you know, when the king is excluded, when he's just elbowed out of things. So we decide Inkatha is not going to participate. And that's by sheer coincidence. There happens to be an academic from Kenya by the name of Washington Okumu. Washington Okumu was invited in Marysburg by African Enterprise, which is an evangelical body led by Michael Cassidy. He happened to have been a student of Kissinger's. So I met him when I attended some of the presidential prayer breakfasts in Washington. So there was now a jet, a government jet, and I was leaving now for Lundi the following day. When I go to Lanzeria, I'm told that Washington Okumu wants to see me. So I waited for a few minutes, 10 minutes or so, but he wasn't. Because unfortunately, there's Dr. Sipho Mzimela, who was my minister, he was a reverend. And that day, the king was going to meet with Archbishop Tutu and other religious leaders at his palace. So we had to get to Lundi. So we took off. Strangely, when we were airborne, we were suddenly told that there's something wrong with the plane. And I was surprised because the plane was fairly new. So we had to go down again to Lanzeria. And there was Okumu. He was a big man. There was he sipping tea, looking larger than life. And then he says to me, he wants to intervene. If I agree, he wants to talk to the king. To Mr. de Klerk, and to talk to Madiba too, and to me, to try and retrieve, something up.
To broker a new arrangement. Yeah.
So I said, well, he can try. Then I left. Then, in fact, he was roving between Cape Town and Johannesburg and Pretoria. And I think Anglo-American helped with the plane too, for him to do that job. Then on the 19th, the election, Miss Cliff was already on the 27th. Mm-hmm. On the 19th of April, Mr. de Klerk, Mr. Mandela, myself, met in Pretoria, and we agreed on an agreement for peace, that the international mediation will take place as soon as possible after the election. So I announced that day to the Inkatha, which had become Inkamba Freedom Party then, mm-hmm. that we were going back to election. A few days.
You had very little time to prepare.
Yes. Then, of course, fortunately, we won the province anyway. Of course, Zulu-Natal with a clear majority. And there was this government of national unity, of course, which was prescribed by the interim constitution, that any party that had more than 5% would have a seat in the government of national unity. But sometimes, with all the love I have for Madiba, some people try to give him credit that, Buthelezi was troublesome, but he allowed him in his cabinet.
No, he had to.
He had to do that. But he was too glad with that. Because all the time, my participation in the cabinet, I could feel hostility of some of my colleagues all the time, I still remember piloting my immigration, my immigration bill, that it was debated for 3 hours, no other one. And it was given by Mr. Mbeki to individual ministers to tear it apart and so on. I mean, it was not easy at all. So anyway, the election has happened. Then I'm a minister.
Home Affairs.
Yes. Then Mr. de Klerk becomes the second
president. Deputy president.
So I ask him all the time, as soon as possible, what about the intermediation? Then he tells me, when he raises the subject, Mr. de Klerk gets very angry. Mr. Mandela.
Mandela.
Mr. de Klerk says that Mr. Mandela gets angry and doesn't entertain the subject. Just about that time, there appears from nowhere someone called Prince Sifiso Zulu. He says he's a member of the royal family. And actually, my cousin was then regent, because the king had not been installed. Described him very colorfully. He said he could testify that Sifiso Zulu came from King Panda's testicle. This chap now becomes the spokesman for the royal family. He starts making statements that, in fact, the king didn't sign that agreement on the 19th. The king, he speak, and the king doesn't say anything anymore. So somehow the king becomes, you know, mum. And he says all those things that Buthelezi, in fact, has nothing to do with it. The king didn't sign this thing and so on. And the king now says, on behalf of the king, the government will fix this thing or the president of the king. And in 2005, they passed Act number 5 of 2005 in the province. And Section 17 merely says that Isilo, which is another title of the king, Isilo is the monarch of the province, which is meaningless, which has no implications of any sort. So we are trying to pursue, we have tried over the years to pursue real reconciliation between us. But I've left out a lot, of course. I can't say everything.
No, sure.
But I think it's important for me to say, as Minister of Home Affairs, whenever there was SADC, as there can be SADC meeting here in other countries, there was a SADC meeting all of a sudden in Mauritius. So in the afternoon when we finish, I'm suddenly called to Mr. Mandela's suite in his hotel. So that evening, Mr. Mandela says, "Look, Shenge, from here I'm going to America for the first time." And he said, "Mr. Mbeki is in Malaysia, I think, Malaysia. So I'm leaving the country."
You were made president.
Yeah, and of course they were furious, you know.
Didn't we also go to war when you were acting president? We went to war, didn't we?
No, but that was not wrong. That was actually part of the malice, even to refer it, even though we are saying in jest. It was part of the malice of those people who didn't. Because, in fact, I consult that night, we stayed until midnight with Mandela, because he was consulting, because at the time, South Africa chaired SADC, and he was consulting, you know, other heads of state. In fact, I remember a big joke that, 12, he looked at his watch at 12. At that time, relationship between him and Mugabe were frosty. So he said, and he touched me, he said, "Look, we are now the president. Talk to Mugabe." Because he didn't want to talk to you. So then I consulted, I spoke to Mr. Mugabe, President Mugabe. I speak to President Mokhai. I get letters and phone calls from the Prime Minister of Lesotho. The coup is just about to take place. So I consult with Mr. Mandela, even though I was away, that, you know, the Prime Minister say that, you know, they're on the verge of a coup. So I say I've decided then that we should send troops from South Africa and also from Botswana. So there was actually SADC, you know, what you call,
no, it wasn't South Africa.
Combined force, right. Yes. So they went there. So concerning, you know, Ms. Cliff, this joke you're making about the war, because even the president, our president, has been there. And I remember him joking. You remember he intervened too during Mr. Zuma's time. He said, "Oh, some people were asking me, where is that man who invaded us?" I said, "Actually, it's a fallacy, because I was invited for the wedding of King Lazy III. And when the VIPs were introduced, you know, I remember to recount I was there and other luminaries. But when my name was announced, the whole stadium shook, and with women ululating, you know. And during the lunch, judges, magistrates, businessmen at the lunch said, "You saved our country from a bloodbath."
Absolutely.
That was the reality, apart from those who were promoting the story that, you know, because of warlike propensities of the Zulu people that I did that. And they were even saying that Sipiwe Nyanda, who was the chief of, they said, It's unfortunate that he was the head of army. So the Zulus are known, you know, the people of violence.
It's a stereotype.
It had nothing to do with that.
What about this marriage? You have been married to your wife all your life. You know, your marriage. Marriage. This is, and we see so many politicians who have this wife, then they change it to that wife, then they have a girlfriend, then they have this. It seems to me that you practice what you preach here. Your wife has been, throughout your political career, someone you could have relied upon at any time. She was very much your equal partner in many respects. You have had three sons, five daughters.
Yes.
The family is strong. It means a lot to you.
Yes, the sad thing is we've had, you know...
Tragedy.
Almost 68 years now.
Mm.
And the only tragedy, of course, that five of my children have died.
Mm.
You know, I've got my son here and his two sisters on the left. You know, so I really have been blessed. Well, some people ask, you know, Ms. Cliff, why is it that since my father was married to 20 wives, and it's a prerogative of people in my position to take more wives? I think I was partly influenced by my uncle, my mother's younger brother, who was regent, because he suddenly got married to one wife too, and I was also then active in my church, attending synods and so on, and etc. I just thank God I cannot boast about it, because I cannot say there were no temptations on the way. If I said so, I would not be a human being.
Of course. But you're a man of principle. You've been called many things by people: political enemies, people within movements that you were a member of. Even your own party, there were people at one stage who said, "Oh no, you've been around too long." You know, you stepped down in January.
Yes,
you made yourself unavailable for election.
Even now, she can tell you she's a member of our highest body, Miss Van der Merwe. She knows that the top structure of the party, they surrounded me and said, you know, since we could not hold our conference, and therefore the man who had identified to lead has not been formally elected, although he has been identified. We don't have money. We're not a rich party. We have a conference. They are asking me to lead the election. And of course, I was very much against it, very reluctant to do that, you know, because I'd already planned my arrest and so on. So I insisted that we should call a meeting of all structures, which almost was like a conference itself, people from all branches and all structures. And I asked them, the top people, in front of our members, to say what they said to me. I said, I will not present it, as if I'm persuading, God recall. So each one of them did so. And it was all the structures then that surrounded me and said, please, please, please. So I'm reluctantly leading my party in the election because, of course, it is my legacy, it is my party. Mm. Since it was clear that you were in a fix because of this, then I'm leading for whatever remains.
We
hope that we'll have a conference.
Apart from these immediate elections, which we don't need to go into too much about because we won't predict the future. We don't know what will happen. What would you like your legacy to be, both for the IFP and your legacy in South Africa? What would you like people to say about you? The way they talk about other political leaders, there are sometimes nice things and sometimes not such nice things. How would you like people to describe your contribution?
Well, I would say that I hope they understand that I try to practice servant leadership. This young lady has worked with me, like others. He knows that whereas people are trying to think that I dictate, I never dictate. In fact, they get very annoyed with me. in the way I consult them and say, as I've given you the picture now, I never dictate to the party. And I hope, therefore, that they will say that he served his people, you know, to the best of his ability and in accordance with the dictates of his conscience.
You couldn't ask for more than that. Thank you so much for giving some time of your
birthday. But recently, let me say, as a postscript to that, I was invited, you know, last month to Zambia by the Ngoni people. The Ngoni people are Zulus who fled after Mfecane from King Shaka.
Mm.
And in fact, I told you that in Malawi too, I was flown up to see them, a section of them in Malawi. So their first fruit ceremony, and they invited me, and I was able to meet with the head of state, President Lungu, and also my friend and elder brother, President Kaunda, and he made an extraordinary statement. Because actually, I should have brought you the statement so that I could read it here, because he said that it was actually a decision of the frontline states with Tambo that I should lead Gozul, because they said they couldn't identify anyone who could do that. And he complimented me for having done so well. And then this month, on the 5th of this month, I was in Lagos. I was in Nigeria, invited by the former head of state, President Olusegun Obasanjo, who I've already mentioned invited me when he was head of state, even before he became president, invited me on his 82nd birthday to deliver a lecture on his birthday. And he always says, and he quoted even in his speech there, that when he came to this country as one of the eminent persons group, they all wanted to see Madiba in jail, but they were not allowed. He was allowed. And at the time, of course, there was the only voice in South Africa. And he asked, who is this Buthelezi? And he said, Madiba said, Comrade Buthelezi is a freedom fighter in his own right.
Yeah, there are many other great things that we can say. Yeah. And I wish you luck for the elections. I hope that your party, which is diverse, which is a party that has contributed enormously to South Africa already, continues to grow. And thank you for spending some of your time with us, sir.
Mr. Cliff, thanks to you for giving me the opportunity to say the things that I'm saying. Because there have been a lot of lies around my life and propaganda and vilification. You know, at one time I was the flavor of the month in the media. But later on, when corruption started, it actually started in the media with brown envelope journalism. And I suddenly became, you know, the black sheep.
Well, yes. Well, you've lived a long life. You've met everyone that has made South Africa what it is today. And some of these people were known to you very well.
Because, you know, Mr. Cliff, I always say it's very funny because, you know, I said I was received by Emperor Haile Selassie, I was received by Kaunda, I was received by Olusegun. These are heads of state in Africa. I was received by Nyerere, I was received by Lady Thatcher, I was received by Chancellor Kohl. If I was the sellout that they tried to portray me to be, I would never set my foot. You know, I was received by President Reagan, President Bush, Prime Minister Ten Old. In Liberia, I was invited by President Tolbert, and he actually awarded me one of their highest national awards as Knight Commander of the Star of Africa.
That's right, for outstanding leadership.
Quite so.
1975.
Correct. You know.
At the funeral of Winnie Madikizela Mandela.
Oh, yes. In fact, it is very interesting about that because we as political party leaders, opposition, were called and briefed by the president and also by Dr. Kosazana Zuma. And some of my colleagues said that they also wanted to say something. And both the president and Dr. Zuma said no. In fact, as far as Prince Buthelezi is concerned, it's the family that want him to speak.
High honor. Well, it's been my honor to spend time with you. Thank you again, sir. Yabonga.
Kakhulu. Yabonga. Nami ngiyabonga. Mnumzane Cliff, ngiyabonga kakhulu.
This is CliffCentral.com.